Welcome to Goodniks, a podcast about doing good in the world. Together, we dig into the experiences of people who do good in very different ways to understand what inspires them, what frustrates them, and what keeps them going. I'm Annalisa Enrile, a social worker, professor, and human rights activist. Whether you're doing good yourself or just thinking about it, I'm glad you're here. In our last episode, we talked to our Goodniks about who keeps them going. We heard stories about the people who light their way and give them strength. In this episode, we hear how our Goodniks convert the worst moments in their lives into good work in the world. When faced with tragedy and trauma, how do they remain hopeful and even use their trauma as a catalyst of their work or to recommit to their work?
I don't know that there's ever been anybody other than like my dad who's like, you really have to go to law school, Jesse. Like, you're going to need to grow up and get like a real job. And like this movement building thing is like cute. My dad would now be happy to say that he was wrong. And it's really cool that I figured out how to build a whole career in movement building. But I had a lot of encouragement throughout my life.
Jesse is an expert in building movements, organizing thousands or sometimes millions of people to make change.
I feel like this is like the story that never ends, because it was like I was graduating college and I took the LSAT and I applied to law school and I got into law school. But then I was an entrepreneur and I was starting an organization. So it was like, I'm just going to defer a year while I go continue my activist life. And my dad's like, that's cool. That's great. Okay, you'll defer a year. And I got into like a really cool program, this like joint NYU-Harvard program that was public policy and studying critical race theory, which was like my dream and before the whole world was talking about critical race theory. And then I was so into the political activism work I was doing. I was like, okay, I'm gonna beg NYU to let me defer one more year. And my dad's like, okay, as long as you're going, you wouldn't be stupid enough to pass up this great opportunity. So I defer a second year, and then I'm ready to start. And a kind of life-changing thing happened to me, which is I got diagnosed with what was said to me at the time, an incurable autoimmune disease. And I was being treated in Washington, D.C. I had cancer. That cancer led to the diagnosis of this incurable autoimmune disease. And I was supposed to move from D.C. to New York to start law school. And my doctors at Johns Hopkins say, you should just stay here. So I call NYU and I'm like, I can't start law school for medical reasons. And they let me start law school as a visiting student in Washington, D.C. And the idea is when I get better, then I'll finally move to New York and do the whole law school thing. At the same time, I get recruited into the whole youth climate movement. So I'm like fighting cancer and an autoimmune disease. And I'm like taking a night class at Georgetown. And I'm also like now accidentally building a youth climate movement. And so the truth is, I never told my dad I wasn't going to be a lawyer. I just like very slowly went to school at night for many, many years. I still have not finished my like last paper for my last class. So I do not have the law degree, but I went to school for many, many years in the evenings. So I have that education that I can finish. And I had this whole other career in the meantime. And so I proved to my dad bit by bit that actually I could make this all happen. And that there was a big, beautiful movement building life out there that did not, in fact, require a law degree. I am on day 98 of recovering from my third bone marrow transplant in my life. So I have been in isolation for the last 98 days recovering from bone marrow transplant number 3. So in the background of this like totally dynamic, amazing life of movement building, I've had these like huge personal health challenges and cancer many, many times, et cetera, et cetera. So what does that have to do with whether I think the universe like was telling me I should be a movement builder? I just think these two things have some like deep symbiotic relationship. Like, I think my ability to feel so passionate about the fight related to the movement building has something to do with a struggle to stay alive and get healthy. And like, I also think that I have been able to stay alive and be healthy because I got to get back in the fight. And like, I've had doctors actually say this. It's crazy, Jesse. There's like something in you that's driving you, right? It's not about taking time off work. It's like, how do I reboot myself so I can go back in the fight? And I think that drive to like unlock movement power, the like awe-inspiring opportunities I've had to be in Kenya and in India and on the streets of Brazil during elections and bring people into movements is so intoxicating that during this last 100 days of recovery, like that is what's fueling this 4'10" little Jewish girl from Milwaukee to get through this brutal process of a bone marrow transplant and get at it again. So I don't know. I feel like I wouldn't have survived all of this if I weren't a movement person. And there's certainly like some really powerful relationship there. It's a pretty unique thing to be turning 41 years old and having gone through the experience multiple times in my life of wondering whether or not I was at the end of my life. When I was 25 and diagnosed with an incurable autoimmune disease, that doctor looked me in the eye and told me, you're not going to make it till 30. Obviously, I walked out of his office and I was never going to see him again because that wasn't going to be the plan. And I found another amazing doctor who begged to differ. And when I did turn 30, I had an epic party to celebrate. And I basically just have epic parties every single year to celebrate. But as I mentioned, I'm on day 98 of this latest battle of coming back from my third bone marrow transplant. And bone marrow transplants are very scary. They like basically take you as close to the brink of not being alive. And then you have to work yourself back up to having an immune system again. And you're so weak, you can't really do much. There's like a lot of time to think. And I honestly think like being a part of movements and movement building is like one of the greatest gifts that I've had because I have not had to wonder in those moments of, is my body going to like make it this time or not? I haven't had to wonder, did I spend my life and my days like doing something that was worth it? I've never had to wonder that, for me at least. Someone else might make judgment that like, I should have spent the time making money or I should have spent the time doing all sorts of other things. But for me, like I've never had to hesitate ever. If you can be a movement builder and you can balance that with enjoying the remarkable ride of building great relationships and not getting so wrapped up in the movement that you forget your family and you forget your friends, it's a pretty awesome thing to know that if it were all to end in a moment, you spent your moments doing the right thing. And I feel like it's been a tremendous privilege more than anything to live this life.
Our Goodniks are no different than anyone else. They inevitably confront tragedy and trauma in their lives and in the lives of the people they work with. But Jesse and the others convert that tragedy into fuel to keep going.
Yossi uses arts and culture to organize people in politics or for social change.
After doing the Hope posters and helping do my part, as so many people did, to kind of reinvest in hope and to kind of expand the audience of people who felt like they had a stake in the American future. And I was invited to go in and work at the White House. And I did. I had at the time, I think I was 4 years sober, maybe 3 years sober, after getting to a point in my life where I was barely employable, barely able to show up for my friends and family in a way that was esteemable, and recommitted to myself, to my family, to my community, to live in a way that would allow me to be productive and to be a contributing member. And I just started saying yes to opportunities and doing things that felt more in harmony with where I wanted to go in the world. That all made sense. And then I was offered an opportunity to go from the White House, which is executive branch, which is a kind of a temporary and liminal kind of experience. Not all people work at the White House continue to work in government. I made a decision to go work in government as a political employee, as an appointment, which in hindsight never sat well with me and I never should have done. I'm an activist by trade. I am an activist by nature. If I am not moving forward, I don't feel like I'm doing enough. If I'm not advancing myself, the field, my community, the world, then I get restless, irritable, and full of discontent. And holy moly, government employee is not the right title for somebody who feels that way. And I went against kind of what I knew in my heart to be the right thing to do. And it bit me in the ass. And I was unable to square who I was and the job that was given to me. What they wanted was someone to write press releases. What I wanted to do was expand the power and the understanding of the arts in the United States. And those two didn't square. And I couldn't get those to align. And the universe summarily ejected me from government for that reason. Like they said, yeah, this isn't right for you. And realigned me with what was my true path, which was this exploring this deep connection that I had a very tertiary understanding of between culture, communications, and purpose. And I spent the next 10 years, well now older, 15, almost 20 years, figuring out how those three align and where the deltas are and where they need to contract and where we need to build new systems, where we need new language, and what it's going to take for us to make sure that this becomes something that is considered whenever anybody sets out to change the world.
Jennifer is a neonatal ICU nurse where she spends her days caring for critically ill babies.
So here begins the overshare. When I got pregnant with my son, I was in a not so happy marriage. And when I found out that I was pregnant, so much of what I was okay with, I wasn't okay with for my son. And I recognized, again, this is going to be an overshare, but my ex-husband didn't know how to control his anger. And he liked to raise his voice, and sometimes he raised his hands. And as much as I put up with that for me, because I was just in a different place in my head and in my life, I thought about what it would look like if my son would raise a hand. I thought about what it would feel like if my son would raise his voice, either to me or to somebody that he loved. And without recognizing the power of what I was doing, I broke that cycle. And I decided the next generation was not going to be that in my family. And before my son was born, I started mailing things home. And shortly after his birth, I left and filed for divorce from across the country, from a different state. And so the process of becoming a parent for me was enormous. It wasn't just all of a sudden I had to think about diapers and bottles and breastfeeding. It was thinking about what I wanted my legacy to be and what I wanted the rest of my life to look like. And when I got pregnant, I took a birthing class. And it was a 13-week course that was supposed to teach me how to deliver my son without medical intervention. And this fierce hippie in me felt like that's how it was going to go. And the more birth videos that I watched, the more I believed that I could deliver this kid squatting in a bathtub. And I got very idealistic about it. But the course itself was based on science, and it was about understanding the process of fetal development and understanding that the pain of delivery serves purpose. And it was very medical based. So I became very inspired by pregnancy and fetal development and in delivery. And so when it came time for my son to be born and things seemed like they were progressing, I didn't go into labor. Nothing happened the way that it was supposed to, which is what I've learned happens when you write these big elaborate birth plans. Real life takes over. And my son ended up being an emergency C-section. He came out and needed to be resuscitated because he had the cord wrapped around his neck. And he ended up staying the first 7 days of his life in the NICU. And I was just inspired. I mean, the journey of a baby going from fetus to baby is unbelievable when you really sit and learn about everything that has to happen and the number of things that could go wrong. The journey from being a self-absorbed, self-driven person to becoming a parent was this birth of me. And I got to come into the greatest part, the best chapter of my life and start over. And I was inspired. I was inspired not just by what my son had to go through to be born, but what I had to go through to become a parent. And the people that were involved in the birthing class that I took and the nurses that tried to help me in the hospital to deliver without medical intervention. And even the people in the NICU that walked me through that journey from what really was a very dark place into the light of being a parent, I recognized how incredible that path was that they got to be a part of, and they will forever be a part of that. And there's some of them that I remember, and I can't say I know their names or their faces, but I remember what they did. And when I got to the other side of it, I felt this draw to help other people make that not just a journey, but it's like a birth. It's a transformation. And I felt the draw to help people through that because there had to be purpose in what I went through.
Sam is a police officer in a small town in New York State.
My dad became ill with cancer at the end of 2003, 2004. And he had been going through chemotherapy. He was diagnosed with MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome, which is ultimately a form of leukemia. And as the treatment was not working and he continued to get sicker and sicker, they decided he needed a stem cell transplant. At that time, I was in seventh grade, I believe. So I was 11, 12 years old. I don't think that I really thought about being a cop. I think at that time I was just like any other kid. You see a police car and you think it's cool because the lights, and you see the cop in uniform and they also look cool because they're wearing a uniform. But at that time, I don't think I dreamt so much about being a cop. It was always just an interest of mine. When my father had to get his stem cell transplant, my parents had to move to Minneapolis. My mentor, who's a close family friend, his sister, who was also a local, they're from a local family, that she lived with my sister and I in my house. Her boyfriend at the time was a police officer in the city, in the Bronx, in a pretty dangerous neighborhood of the Bronx. And what would happen is every day I'd come home from school and I would have to get my homework done. And he would come after work to spend some time with his girlfriend. And I used to love to hear the stories about his day at work. So what he did, whether it was chasing someone down and tackling them or helping a family out, he would always come up with a story to tell me. And naturally, hearing the stories, I became enamored with the profession. And I also loved the show Cops. So my reward for getting my homework done and behaving, because I was acting out at that age, was to sit down and listen to John's stories of being a cop in the Bronx and get to watch Cops, where he used to criticize all the cops and what they did wrong. And through listening to his stories and hearing the excitement that he got to have every day in his job and being outside and driving the police car, and that has really turned me on to become a cop, because he really did so much good in the NYPD, and he would tell me about it. And I thought it was so interesting that he wasn't from the city, he wasn't from the Bronx, but he still went down to the Bronx every day and still put himself in danger, not because he was getting paid to do it, not because the benefits were good, but because he really loved his job and because he was happy doing it. Even though he may have gotten hurt one day, or even though one day his partner was shot. And that's what made me fall in love with the job. My dad ultimately passed away in 2007. So that was about not a whole year after he came back from Minneapolis after his transplant. And I went through a rough patch in high school in which I had dealt with the cops in high school, or I should say, which they had to deal with me. I gave the school a lot of problems and it continued. But I went to college at John Jay in hopes of, and then studied police studies and becoming a cop. And I learned more about it and more about it and more about it. But when I became a cop, the real reasons were to give back to my community, to help people that were in need. And one of my ultimate goals was to help the kids and give back and help kids that were in need in Hastings, because there were a whole bunch of kids that needed some guidance that were going through rough patches that I think the cops were able to provide for me as being good role models. The cops were all really good role models for me when I was going through a really rough time. So basically when I became a cop, that's the basic answer, is I really wanted to do it to do good and give back to Hastings, to give back to my community. And like I said, the basic answers, the generic answers. But since I've become a cop, I think that my realization of just not that being a police officer is not so much just driving around in the police car and looking good in the uniform, and not as basic as helping the kids or going on a crazy call. But every day there's something different. Every day your career as a police officer provides you opportunities to make a difference. And every day it's something different. Every day it's not going to be the same thing. And I think one of the biggest things for me is that the fact that I can be outside in a police car and drive around and see new things and meet new people every day, it becomes something that changes your outlook on life, and the way that through meeting people and making connections of people that have all lived a different life and all have had different experiences, and it being able to talk to them changes the way that you live your life. And it's changed the way that I've lived my life, and it's changed the way that I think about it.
David founded a nonprofit that organizes against genocides around the world.
So I will acknowledge that, you know, as far as like our top, you know, what are the biggest challenges facing the world? What do we got? We got climate change, big one, right? That's coming for all of us. We better get our act together. And there are a variety of others: inequality, corruption the world over, the erosion of democracy, and sort of tipping back towards the realms of authoritarianism in a multipolar authoritarian world with world powers. But to me, it all boils down to unresolved trauma. We have generations and generations of unresolved and transmitted ancestral trauma as it relates to our countries and the West's original sin with respect to slavery, genocide of indigenous peoples. And that reverberates, it has echoes in our society, and we haven't done the full work to do even step one. So that is some really difficult work that we're going to have to do. And that needs to begin in schools. There's so much that we could be doing. And the thing that drives me nuts is when I see again and again, opportunities for allyship just fall apart and disintegrate before we've even begun because of the previous trauma acting on us when we're showing up at a school board meeting, or the five-year-old version of ourselves that has trauma speaking up rather than the adult in the room. And it comes down to safety. Until we're able to honor those three human rights, the right to be, the right to belong, the right to become our best selves, then I think we are going to have a very difficult time tackling really any challenge in our society. After the very first Together Remember vigil that we organized on Duke's campus, right, there was this moment where I saw survivors of different atrocities and genocides come together. And I saw this almost like it was nuclear, not fusion, like you could just create more energy out of nothing when people who had suffered similar kinds of atrocities come together. There's just like this epic multiplier effect of healing. And then when others who are not party to that conflict witness that, they then believe in more possibilities for what their community can achieve across lines of difference. And we can talk about hard stuff, whether it's Israel-Palestine or race relations in America. Like, we were able to cultivate that because the survivors were willing to show up and say, hey, what are we willing to do to prevent the next names from being added to this list? Speaking of names, that was part of our sort of strategy, was we wanted to build the world's first database of names of victims, of not just victims of one genocide, but of all genocides and atrocities, because we needed that. So we started with six genocides that I was aware of, but now my understanding has exploded and I know of dozens of atrocities and genocides, but it was only in college that I began to learn about that, which was also a source of my resentment towards mainstream establishments that I had grown up in. I understand why they existed, but I reached out to some very well-known Holocaust memory institutions, let's say the world's leading institutions. And I said, hey, can you supply your list of thousands of names? I see part of it's on the website. And they said, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially, yes, but only if you don't combine them with the names of other genocide victims on Holocaust Remembrance Day. To which I basically just told that person to F off. That was like the moral injury right there. That was the first one. And that's when I realized that the big issue is this territoriality of memorying, this zero-sum perspective on how we go about remembering the past and educating and advocating for our peoples in the present.
When adversity strikes in our lives, it's tempting to shut down. Trauma affects us emotionally, mentally, and even physically, causing sadness, anxiety, and confusion, among other things. We hear a lot about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But as our Gudnik showed us today, there's also the potential for post-traumatic growth. Social scientists have found that tragedy often gives us a new appreciation for life, a sense of our resilience and strength, and redirects our focus to helping others. How do we recover from adversity? How do we persevere in doing good? There are five things that make a difference: our gratitude and appreciation for life, our relationships, our belief in what's possible, our emotional strength, and our belief in something greater. When something bad happens, what do you do? Do you give up and give in? Or do you reset, restart, and recommit to the good that you are doing in the world? In our next episode, we talk to our Gudniks about what they might have told their younger selves. What did their younger selves need to know about doing good in the world? Thank you for being part of Gudniks. Gudniks was created and executive produced by Jeff Leitner, produced by Amanda Roscoe Mayo, with original music by Adam Ohlendorf. I'm your host, Annalisa Enrile. Gudniks is supported by the Jim Joseph Foundation and inspired by every one of you who is doing good in the world. To learn more about Gudniks, visit gudniks.org. That's GOODNIKS.org. Or follow us on Twitter at The Gudniks and on Instagram at the_Gudniks.